Hello and welcome. You are listening to Patrick Boyle on Finance, a podcast exploring ideas from quantitative finance, examining events occurring in markets right now and financial history to see what lessons can be taken away, including interviews with some of the most interesting people in the world of finance. To learn more about the podcast, visit onfinance.org.
China's economy has been struggling to reawaken from an economic shutdown that officially ended last year. Chinese authorities are now reported to be pressuring economists and analysts within the country to avoid discussing any negative trends and to avoid using the word deflation as concerns grow about the leadership's ability to stimulate the economy. In April, consumer confidence fell back to the lows of 2022, according to China's National Bureau of Statistics, which then promptly stopped releasing the figure. Many people, including me, expected to see much more of a recovery in consumption in China as the extreme lockdowns were brought to an end last year and people returned to normal life. In 2021, when the first lockdown ended in China, we saw consumption grow around 9%, along with strong exports and strong business investment. During that period, Chinese GDP grew strongly without a significant increase in the debt burden, which implies that it was high-quality growth rather than GDP growth driven by malinvestment. 2022, which followed, was obviously a terrible year for China, with the extreme lockdowns that occurred particularly in cities like Shanghai, where residents couldn't leave their homes. It seemed reasonable to expect some sort of bounce back this year once the pandemic lockdowns had ended. Instead, we've seen month after month of bad numbers, weak consumption, weak retail sales, exports down a little and imports down a lot, which is another sign of low consumption in China. The country's property sector, which has driven more than 25% of its GDP in recent years, is in very rough shape. We've discussed that for a number of years here on this channel. Property developers who carry debts that come to around 16% of Chinese GDP are still struggling to meet their obligations. Two of them, Country Garden and Sino Ocean, have recently missed bond payments. Entities linked to the conglomerate, Zhongji, have failed to make payments, sparking concern over the country's wealth management industry and its exposure to a troubled property market. Zhongji is a diversified enterprise with stakes in everything from financial businesses to mining companies to venture capital. Its investments are estimated to come to at least $140 billion. Zhongji holds a strategic stake in Zhongrong International Trust, which last week failed to repay the proceeds of two financial products. Trust companies like this one have historically been an important source of financing for the now struggling property sector. Trouble at firms like this are worrying as, for example, KBC Corporation, which manufactures carbon composite products that are part of the semiconductor supply chain, have announced that they have not received around $8.25 million from Zhongrong that they were due. The worry is that if these trust companies are hiding big losses, there could be contagion where losses from the property sector are finding their way into other sectors of the Chinese economy. The Chinese government, facing an expected seventh consecutive monthly increase in youth unemployment 2 weeks ago, announced that it was suspending the release of that data. On top of this, the demographic problems brought about by the one-child policy are growing. Most economists agreed that Chinese exports are unlikely to grow this year, as the global economy is not exactly booming and China's trade with the United States, its best customer, shrank by 20% in July compared with a year earlier. America is both shunning exports from China and restricting investment in China. So consumption is not recovering. The property sector is unlikely to recover anytime soon. The government is currently demolishing unneeded buildings. And the only remaining source of growth is renewed infrastructure spending, which Beijing doesn't want to do as the country already has too much infrastructure. And this is the big source of debt and malinvestment. China's once successful growth model, which did work in the past when there was a huge need for investment in infrastructure, stopped working 10 to 15 years ago. The country now needs to change gear and shift to a new growth model. So let's look at what China might do to recover from this slowdown. Let's discuss the reduced tax on share trading that was announced this morning and how the Chinese slowdown might affect people in other countries around the world. Before digging into that, let me tell you about today's podcast sponsor, Copilot. Copilot is an affordable one-on-one remote personal training service that I've been using for around a month now. Copilot is not just a workout app. When you sign up, you fill out a form allowing them to analyze your fitness goals. They then pair you up with a remote personal trainer who puts together customized, personalized workouts tailored to your goals and the exercise equipment that you have available. If you have an Apple Watch, you can set it up so that your coach can see what's going on during your workouts using motion tracking technology. I don't wear an Apple Watch, so I just use the app on my phone, and I find it great. The phone app shows you the correct form for all of the exercises that you need to do. When I have any questions, I can contact my trainer, Mike, and he gets back to me usually in a few minutes. One thing I find really helpful, because I travel a lot, is that I can message Mike to let him know that I won't have access to any workout equipment for a few days, and he'll put together some workouts that are body weight only so that I can exercise from wherever I am. The best thing about Copilot is that your trainer is a real person and you get the kind of accountability and support you would expect from a real person, but you have the flexibility to work out on your own schedule, which really works for busy people. You can get all of this for a fraction of the cost of in-person training. Click the Copilot link in the show notes to get a 14-day free trial with your own personal trainer. A decade ago, China's National Bureau of Statistics provided a vast amount of economic data. More than 80,000 time series were made available for analysis. Many people questioned the accuracy of the data, but it was made available. 5 years later, the number of economic indicators available had halved, and they've halved again in the last 5 years to fewer than 20,000 time series. Viewed in this context, the decision to suspend the release of youth unemployment data seems less surprising and is just a continuation of a trend towards greater opacity as the economy has been growing less. A spokesman for the National Bureau of Statistics in China told the press that the government had stopped publishing this data as the surveys need to be further improved and optimized. China's youth unemployment rate has doubled in the last 4 years as the economic volatility during the pandemic made companies more wary of hiring. Worse yet, young Chinese university graduates are 1.4 times more likely to be unemployed. China Tobacco Henan, a state-owned tobacco factory, announced a few months ago that almost a third of its new factory floor hires had postgraduate degrees, which triggered national debate in China over whether these highly educated young people were wasted on the assembly line, or had they in fact made a smart decision given the higher than average wages paid by the company and the job stability provided. Since 1999, there's been a big push to educate more of the workforce in China, and higher education expanded faster than market demand for university graduates did, meaning that there are more college graduates in China than there are jobs to pay them. And as a result, a high portion of Chinese youths are unemployed, with others being underemployed, having taken jobs that they're overqualified for. As it stands right now, the jobless rate of 16 to 24-year-olds hit 21.3% in June, an all-time high, before reporting of the data was suspended. The political push to reduce negative economic commentary from economists and analysts based in China comes after a long series of disappointing economic data, points that have undermined investor confidence and hindered Beijing's efforts to spur a robust rebound. Last month, the Communist Party's Politburo admitted that the recovery was making torturous progress. Since the unlock in December, Chinese cities have become busy once again, with traffic jams and so on. There's been an increase in spending on travel and catering. Car sales are strong, but this is tied to significant government support. Almost all other durable goods sales are down quite a lot. A somewhat interesting data point is that there's been double-digit growth in the sales of gold and precious jewellery in China so far this year. According to the World Gold Council, Chinese customers bought 198 tons of gold jewellery in the first quarter of 2023, the highest number recorded since 2015 in the same quarter. Gold purchases in China made up for 41% of the global sales during this time. Spending on jewellery like this could be viewed as consumption, but it might equally be driven by an urge to store wealth outside of the financial system and nervousness over real estate prices. The World Gold Council note in their report that Chinese retailers have moved to pricing items on a per gram of gold basis rather than simply displaying the price of the finished item, which possibly indicates that people are buying jewellery as a store of wealth rather than to wear. When I was discussing this with a friend of mine, she mentioned that these gold purchases could be driven by a lack of trust in the recently introduced central bank digital currency in China too. At this point, it's all speculation as to why people are doing what they're doing, but this data might be worth monitoring. Real estate is, of course, the most important sector in China. As I mentioned earlier, it represents over 25% of Chinese GDP, and China's property sector is, in fact, considered the world's largest asset class with a value of $62 trillion. Real estate makes up two-thirds of private household asset allocations compared to the 4% allocated to equities in China. The majority of Chinese household wealth is tied to real estate. Prices for existing properties in China's 100 biggest cities have dropped by 14% compared with their 2021 peaks. When you consider that the typical down payment on a home in China is 24%, this means that more than half of recent home buyers' wealth has been wiped out. That 14% drop is for the 100 biggest cities in China. I wasn't able to get good data on real estate performance in smaller cities, other than finding reports that the big cities are performing better than small cities are. China is planning to guide mortgage financing rates lower and reduce down payment requirements to help revive real estate prices. The Minister of Housing and Urban Rural Development recently told developers that more loosening measures would be implemented to spur a market recovery given the sector's importance and contribution to the nation's economy. As I mentioned in my recent video on real estate affordability around the world, Chinese homeowners already pay some of the highest multiples of income of any country in the world. House prices being pushed up even higher does not seem like it would make an awful lot of sense in any sort of long-term view of things. Cutting rates and reducing down payments might be expected to revive a sluggish housing market if households and businesses were eager to buy property but unable to come up with the capital. The problem in China over the last few years hasn't been expensive mortgages restraining buyers, but instead a growing realization that real estate prices are no longer likely to keep going up. The only way lower mortgage rates would push up real estate prices is if the new low rates were to spark off fresh speculative demand based on reviving the belief that home prices can rise more than the economy grows going forward. Not only is that unlikely, but even if it could be done, it would be economically harmful in the long term. China's residential real estate prices are already at least 2 to 3 times what the size of the economy can justify. While some might hope that the situation rebalances, not through falling prices, but rather through steady real estate prices and rising GDP, it would take more than 30 years of GDP rising by 3 to 4% for this to happen. That's a very long time to wait for real estate prices to become rational, and so there doesn't appear to be any way to avoid falling property prices, which will be very painful for Chinese households. The government would possibly be better off looking for ways to reduce that pain rather than trying to avoid the unavoidable. A real estate collapse in China would be quite wide-reaching within the economy, affecting banks, households, investors, suppliers, and workers in the construction industry. According to a recent piece in The Economist, China's economic miracle is long over. Its economy has matured, its workforce is shrinking. They argue that business confidence has suffered due to the regulatory storm that struck the nation after 2020, humbling China's technology companies like Alibaba and all but killing the edtech industry. The various crackdowns and lockdowns left the business community with the new belief that the government is now willing to sacrifice economic growth for other ends. Falling confidence means that foreign direct investment all but vanished in the second quarter of 2023, falling by 87% year on year to $4.9 billion as multinationals repatriated their earnings rather than reinvesting them in the country. Some analysts make the argument that while debt loads in China are very high, the debt is mostly internal, with external debt making up only 14% of GDP, compared to the United States, where external debt is more than 95% of GDP. This possibly shows a lack of understanding of debt, as who the debt is owed to doesn't really matter as much to a country as its ability to service the debt. The two biggest debt problems of the last 100 years were the United States at the end of the 1920s and Japan at the end of the 1980s. In both of these cases, the debt was mostly internal, and that did nothing to dampen the economic pain that followed. There's an excellent blog post by Michael Pettis of Peking University that I'll link to in the video description. He points out that China currently invests around 42 to 44% of its GDP and that it has invested a similar or larger percentage for decades. It peaked at 47% in 2010. This is an extraordinarily high percentage. According to the World Bank, investment comprises around 25% of global GDP. For more mature capital-intensive economies, investment can make up roughly 15 to 20% of GDP. And for developing economies in the midst of their high growth stages, investment levels tend to reach 30 to 35% of GDP. Unbalanced economies that have traditionally relied on high investment to drive growth, such as South Korea and Taiwan, are also in that 30 to 35% range. A very high level of investment would have made sense 30 years ago, as the country was starved of capital and any money that was invested productively, where the return on investment was greater than the cost of capital and investors were rewarded for the risk that they took. When the economy reached a point where there was more capital than good projects that could use that capital and earn a return on it, investment rates should have fallen. But in China, because the government targeted GDP growth rather than return on investment, money continued to be pumped in to build infrastructure that was not needed and was pumped into the property sector to build homes that people don't live in. In a normal situation, if you take $100 and invest it in a project that yields $90 of value, an asset that doesn't create sufficient cash flow to cover its cost, you're left with a $10 loss, which someone has to absorb. In China, local governments have taken on billions of dollars of debt and are holding on their books billions of dollars of assets that are not worth their claimed value. The assets don't create sufficient cash flow to service the debt, and this has gone on for a long time. This is what's known as malinvestment. The losses associated with this huge malinvestment are real, even if they're not being recognised, and the hit eventually needs to be taken by someone. That could be the local government who built a road to nowhere. It could be the central government in Beijing who bails them out. It could even be the lenders who lent against an asset that's impaired. But the loss, which is real, will eventually be allocated. There are limited ways to grow an economy. It can be grown through increased investment, which, as highlighted by Pettus, is already at an extreme. It can be grown through boosting consumption, which, as I mentioned at the start of this video, is not happening right now. Or it can be grown through increased trade surpluses, which the rest of the world, in particular the United States, are fighting back against. As investment declines from the extreme levels it's currently at, China's GDP growth depends mainly on consumption growth. Replacing investment-driven growth with consumption-driven growth in a seamless manner is something which has never happened in any country before. For consumption to surge with investment and GDP growth dropping sharply, some external factor would need to directly or indirectly drive up growth in household income. Pettus argues that this could happen if China were to transfer roughly 1 to 2 percentage points of GDP every year from local governments and wealthy individuals or the business sector to ordinary households. The problem with trying to do this is that these large transfers would be politically difficult to manage without major changes in the country's economic, financial, and political institutions. There are all sorts of ways that a government can reallocate wealth within an economy, such as reducing payroll taxes, reducing fees that individuals pay like toll roads, improving the pension system, improving the quality of social health care, basically leaving workers with more of what they earn so that they can spend it, which would then boost businesses. Some economists have argued that the government should buy up some of the unsold inventories of China's struggling property developers in order to create affordable rental housing for the poor. All of these would cost the government, but would mean that the citizens have more money to spend. Now, none of this seems particularly likely, as while policymakers in China do appear to recognize the need to boost consumption, they voice a lot of concern about any transfers making the workers lazy. This morning, Beijing cut a tax on stock trading for the first time since the 2008 financial crisis in an attempt to boost the stock market and investor confidence. Chinese stocks initially jumped 5.5%, but then closed just 1.2% higher by the end of the day. By comparison, Chinese stocks closed up more than 9% the day after the levy was last cut in 2008. A change like this would matter much more to traders than it would to long-term investors. Right now, there's no clear action plan from the Chinese government. The most likely outcome is, of course, that policymakers make very few changes until economic reality forces them to. It's impossible to keep such a high investment share forever. A country can't simply spend its way to higher growth, building infrastructure that's both unnecessary and expensive to maintain. China will eventually need to rebalance to get debt under control, and the losses of malinvestment will eventually be recognized and allocated. We don't know to whom. A slowdown in China or a real estate collapse is unlikely to have a huge impact on investors in the rest of the world. Despite the warnings from some market commentators, a Chinese real estate collapse or debt crisis would be nothing like the US real estate collapse in 2008, simply because the Chinese economy is quite isolated from the rest of the world. They've been very protectionist with their investment opportunities and restrictive of what they import from other countries. China does buy in raw materials and certain technology products, and a number of developing countries do have significant business ties to China. But despite any fear-mongering you might read in the press, there's no reason to expect a rerun of 2008. Western companies have started announcing their worries about how a slowdown in China would affect their businesses. China has provided a booming market for products from chemicals to luxury goods to healthcare and travel. The major drive behind Agilent's revenue drop in the latest quarter was the lab instrument maker's business in China, according to Agilent CEO Mike McMullen, prompting the company to lower its annual growth targets. German industrial conglomerate Siemens said that there had been a sharp drop in new orders in China, particularly in its factory automation business. There are sectors that do have lots of exposure to China, but it's mostly an exporting nation rather than importing, and they do have capital controls that have kept Westerners from investing in China in any great size. The Economist argues that Xi Jinping prizes greatness over growth, security over efficiency, and resilience over comfort, and that he wants to fortify the economy, not gratify consumers. Such an approach might lead to a hard landing for China. For investors in the rest of the world, it's of course worthwhile paying attention to the goings-on in the world's second largest economy and thinking about which companies sell the most to China. But the most important thing is to take a long-term view when it comes to investing and not get shaken out when you hear stories of a slowdown. Thanks for tuning into today's podcast. Do check out our sponsor, Copilot, and use the link in the show notes to get a free 14-day trial. Have a great day and talk to you soon. Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe so you're notified when a new episode is posted. Thank you to everyone who is supporting this content on Patreon. If you enjoyed this content, you can find more like it on YouTube, on the Patrick Boyle on Finance channel, or follow us on Twitter @Patrick E. Boyle. Thanks for listening. Bye.